This is The Think Tank, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. With Dr. Mike O'Neill and hosted by Mike Russell. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
Okay, topic of the week. Obviously hot topic, the United States Supreme Court. Our guest for the whole segment, Paul Bender, former Supreme Court clerk, assistant solicitor general of the United States, ASU Law Dean. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
We're excited. Justice Scalia's legacy, how would you describe it?
Well, we're not excited about Justice Scalia's death, but we're excited we get to talk
legacy.
About something. There we go.
Right,
let's
right.
talk about legacy.
I understand. Scalia's legacy, yeah, you know, that's a complicated question because he has very little legacy in terms of his impact on the law of decisions that the court actually made. The things that Scalia wanted to do on the court, he did not do. He wanted to radically change American constitutional law to go back at least 50 years, maybe 100, to get rid of concepts like substantive due process, which resulted in the abortion case Roe and Wade, and which resulted in, say, the same-sex marriage case, and to get rid of things like the Miranda rule in criminal procedure. He wanted to overrule all that stuff and get back to where the country was in the early part of the 20th century. He never succeeded in doing that. He never got the votes to do that. And so he does not have that legacy. It's hard, really, to think of any case that he dominated or any case where he got what he wanted that will remain the law because he kept losing these things. He kept asking to have Roe and Wade overruled, and the court kept turning him down. So his legacy is really a legacy of dissents and a legacy of trying to get the court to return to a view of the Constitution that existed before the Second World War, and he never succeeded in doing that.
He seemed to be on the edge in a number, and we'll get into this in subsequent segments here. There were a whole lot of cases that looked like they were going to be 5-4 that may be 4-4 now. But, yeah. but before we get to that, I wonder if you could give us your take on who you think the leading candidates are for appointment to the vacancy, and do you think any of them are confirmable?
Well, who the leading candidates are for actual appointment turns on, I think, who wins the next presidential election, because I don't think the Republicans are going to confirm anybody that Obama nominates.
Even an appellate court judge who was confirmed 97-0 in the last 2 years, that's still, they're just going to say no.
It depends on who the judge is, but if it's the judge I think you're thinking of, I think they will say no. Because they've said that, and they seem to want to stick to their guns on that, it's very much affected by the presidential election. The presidential candidates who seem to be leading, Cruz and Trump and Rubio, all say they want Scalia replaced by somebody like Scalia.
Well, they're clearly not going to get that from Barack Obama.
Exactly. So he's not going to nominate somebody like that, even if he could find somebody like Scalia. It's hard to find somebody like Scalia because he's all the way over at one end. And as I was just saying, he's out of his jurisprudence was completely out of step with the majority of the court and with the majority of the country. So anyway, I don't think he's going to nominate somebody like Scalia. And if he doesn't, they're not going to confirm him because they want to take a gamble, I think. I'm not a politician, so I'm just speculating here. I think they want to gamble. They want to gamble that they'll win the presidential election and the Republicans will retain control of the Senate, and then they'll get what they want.
Well, in a roundabout terms, those are roughly 50-50 propositions, each
right.
of them.
Probably, and it's a big gamble. But I think that's what they're holding out for, and I think in large part they're going to hold out for that because that's what the presidential candidates want.
Now, I have read a couple of articles. I understand this may not be doable, but is there any possibility of a recess appointment? Is that legal? Is that anything that could happen?
I think so. I think it would be legal. I think the Senate went into recess last Friday, just before Scalia died. So there is a recess now. And it would be theoretically possible during a recess, not only theoretically, if there is a recess now, The president could make a recess appointment, and he doesn't need Senate confirmation for that. I don't think he'll do that. I think it's a bad idea for him to do that.
Be certainly the nuclear option.
Well, I don't think it's a nuclear option. I think what I don't like about it is I don't think we ought to have any federal judges sitting on recess appointments, but certainly not on the Supreme Court of the United States, because you don't have life tenure on a recess appointment. And therefore, your decisions are going to be affected by whether the president's going to renominate you for the permanent seat. And I don't think that's a good idea.
As a recess appointment, what is the term on a recess appointment?
It's till the end of the next session of the Senate.
Okay.
So if he were to make a recess appointment now, I think that appointment would last until a successor is confirmed or until the end of next year.
Okay, now this is what, you know, obviously I don't love justices dying, but I love it when things like this happen in our country because we get to relearn or learn for the first time in many cases how this all works.
Okay.
So what is the unfortunate, I know you're the dean of ASU Law, but unfortunately most of the kids graduating high school right now have no idea, can't even name five of the Supreme Court judges.
Can't name can't name one.
Well, they can name a dead one because it just happened. What are the history of the appointments in the final year of a president's term? Has this happened before and what happened then?
Yeah, it's happened before. I heard somebody on television yesterday who counted them up saying it had happened like 8 times that there have been Supreme Court appointments in the last year of the president's term. So it could happen. There's no rule against it, and it's a thing that would normally happen. If you have a vacancy that needs to be filled, you fill it, even though the president's term is in the last year. But this is an unusual situation for a lot of different reasons. One, there's a presidential election coming up. Two, the court is very, very clearly divided into two sides, and Scalia is clearly on one side. That was not true for most of the times that this happened. At the time, for example, that Justice Kennedy was appointed, which I think was in the last year of Reagan's term, the court was not split in such a definitive fashion, 4 on one side and 4 on another side and somebody in the middle. There was much more flexibility within the court. And so the stakes are much higher. If you know how everybody in the court is going to vote, then in replacing somebody, if you replace them with somebody who's different, you're going to change the result of cases. That's not usually been the situation, but that does seem to be the situation now. For example, the court took a case from California to decide the question of whether public sector unions could collect dues from non-members to pay for the collective bargaining that they did. And the court, the rule now is they can collect dues. The court took that case to overrule that rule. It was going to be a 5-4 decision. Scalia was going to be in the majority. So that would be that case overruled. Scalia has now died. He can't participate. So if they were to vote on that today, it would be a 4-4 case, and it would be affirmed. So the result of that would be changed. That's why the Republicans want Scalia replaced by somebody like Scalia, so those results don't change. That's an unusual situation where you can predict with almost certainty how each of nine members of the court is going to vote. And that's been true about a lot of cases. For example,
Paul Bender, we're up against a commercial right now. When we come back, we'll keep breaking all of this down. The death of Antonin Scalia. We're going right to the source with Paul Bender, former Supreme Court clerk, assistant solicitor general, and ASU law dean. More with Mr. Bender next.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Well, we got the titles wrong. We're going to have to fix this right now. Paul Bender's on the phone.
Former dean.
Former dean. There we go.
And chief deputy assistant solicitor general.
There we go.
I hope
there
I got
go.
That right.
We
got- I didn't write that down. I did that one from memory. Now, I have a question for you, sir. One of the things that's in the offing right now is, in a lot of these cases, the prospect of a 4-4 tie. What happens if there's a tie?
There are two possibilities when there's a tie. One of them is that you affirm the case because it's a tie vote by an equally divided court. And when you do that, the court just says affirmed by an equally divided court, and they do not write an opinion. So it's just as if they never took the case.
Or, which means, I think, it has no precedence outside of the circuit in which
the decision below remains in that circuit, but it's not a precedent for other circuits, and the issue remains, and the court then will take another case sometime. If the issue is one of general importance, which it usually is, they'll take another case and decide it after the court has 9 members. Or if the court feels that they really want to decide the thing in this case right away, as soon as they get a 9-member court so that the tie will be broken, they can set the case down for re-argument next term. And they've done that in the past when they know that by next term there'll be a 9th member. They can have it re-argued, and then they can have it decided by 9 people. Because Scalia cannot participate in any decision.
Yeah. I've heard that those are the two choices, but what's never been explained to me is who decides. Is it the Chief Justice? Is it the 8 members that sit? Who decides whether or not they merely allow the case to be affirmed, or whether they decide to hold it over till they have a 9th justice?
I believe that is by majority vote.
Wow. What if it's 4-4?
It's not up to the Chief Justice.
Okay.
But you have to remember that although I think formally it's a majority vote, they're going to care about their relationships with each other.
Mm-hmm.
So if some people want it to be put over very strongly, others might say, okay, if you really want that, I'll vote for that. So you can't really tell what's going to happen, and they can't tell what's going to happen until they talk to each other about it. I'm saying they'll try to reach a consensus about whether to put it over or not, but they have that choice, and they really won't know what they want to do about that until they have votes on the case. Cases that have already been argued, they know whether Scalia was in the majority. If he wasn't, his death doesn't change the result. If he was in the majority, then if he was in the majority to reverse the case, then his death, if they affirm by a 4-4 vote, would change the result from a reversal to an affirmance.
Now, if it does go and end in a tie, and you said basically the lower court ruling stands at that point, does the lower court ruling become the law of the land as if it were handed down to the Supreme Court?
Oh, absolutely not.
Okay.
Oh, it's just as if the court denied review, denied certiorari, never took the case. That's the result. The case itself is affirmed, but it has no effect on other cases.
I want to walk you through, if I could, some of the cases that look to most observers to be teetering at 4-4 now. There's a contraception case of Life versus Burwell.
Mm-hmm. What about it?
Well, what do you think happens now?
I don't think that case has been argued yet.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll hear argument, and then they'll take a tentative vote. And if the court is 9-0, one way or another, they'll go ahead and decide it. They'll decide it if it's not 9-0, but 8-0. If they're 7-1, they'll go ahead and decide it. If they're 6-2, they'll go ahead and decide it. If they're 4-4, then they have to decide whether to affirm by an equally divided court or set the case down for re-argument. So what I'm saying is they don't know what they're going to do, and you can't know what they're going to do until they take a tentative vote, because some tentative votes, they'll just go ahead and decide the case because Scalia's vote didn't change the result. The only cases where Scalia's death is going to change the result are cases that would have been reversed and Scalia would have been in the majority and they would be decided by a 5-4 vote. That is, if there were 5 votes to reverse and Scalia was one of the 5 and 4 votes to affirm, if Scalia had lived, the case would be reversed. Scalia's death means it would be affirmed.
Now,
unless they hold it over for re-argument.
Are there cases that jump out at you that strike you as likely to now be 4-4?
The one I mentioned before, it seems to me to be the most likely.
The Union case.
It was pretty clear that the court took that case to reverse it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not going to happen anymore with this court, because I don't think there are 5 votes on this court now to reverse it. Scalia was the 5th vote. And there may be a couple of other cases like that, but you're not going to know whether they're like that until they take a tentative vote after the argument. Then they'll see. If Scalia's vote didn't make a difference in the result, they'll go ahead and decide it with an eight-person court. If Scalia's vote would make a difference in whether it's affirmed or reversed, then they have to decide whether they're going to set it over for re-argument or just affirm it. And those are the cases that are most likely to be set over for re-argument, where Scalia's death changed the result. The problem with setting it over for re-argument is, when do you set the re-argument? As things look now, there will not be nine judges at the beginning of next session in October. And there won't be in November, there won't be in December, there won't be in January. Even if the new president immediately makes a nomination when he or she is elected, that's going to take a month or two to confirm. So probably you can't even set them for re-argument next term. If you did, it would have to be the very end of the term.
So we could be looking at 2 years.
Right, and I don't know that the court has ever set a case for re-argument with that long a delay.
Is there a ruling there? Is there a rule on how long they have?
There's no rule at all.
No rule.
But I think that makes it less likely that they'll set the case for re-argument. More likely that they'll just have it affirmed by a 4-4 vote. But the Union case, which people want to reverse it, are really strong that they want to reverse it.
Yeah.
That's one where they may hold out for a re-argument, hoping they'll get a back.
Okay, I'll try to pin you down when we come back on a couple of cases, other ones that I've read that look like they're 4-4, and see if you have any insight in that. We'll be back in the think tank.
Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We're back with Paul Bender, Dean, former Dean, ASU Law School, and Supreme Court expert. We were talking about a number of cases that at least my meager research has shown could end up, or have, at least in the opinion of one observer, have a likelihood of ending up as a 4-4 tie. One of these was a reapportionment, but a districting case in Virginia that involved heavy packing of black voters into one district, having the effect of creating a lot of Republican districts, Virginia 3rd.
Yeah, I'm not aware of that case. I'm not sure the one you're talking about, but we can talk more generally, or I can give you another example.
Yeah, please.
Another example would be the Union case is one that I think we already mentioned. Another example would be an affirmative action case from Texas, where the question is whether University of Texas's affirmative action program, which has race as a factor.
Yeah, that's the big one, yes.
Will be permitted. That case, a lot of people think that case has already been argued, so they have taken a vote. We don't know what the vote is, but it's possible that that case, the vote was 5-4 to reverse, because the lower court upheld the affirmative action program, and I think a lot of people thought after the argument that the court was likely to reverse. If Scalia is one of the five justices who voted to reverse that, now it can't be reversed, because there are only four votes to reverse and four votes to affirm. So the court's going to have to decide with that one whether to just say affirm by an equally divided court, or we're going to hold the case for re-argument. And what I was saying before was that I think the fact that you don't know when you're going to have a ninth justice, it could be as much as a year or more than a year, will make the court more reluctant to set it for re-argument. I think they would be uncomfortable holding a case indefinitely that they've already heard argued, so that they can have it re-argued so that they can decide it. So I think the court's going to lean in favor of just affirming by a 4-4 vote, well, but probably there'll be one or two cases that they will.
It was the Texas case. I was under the understanding that that's the one that Elena Kagan had recused herself from.
She is out of that case. That's true.
So it's not going to be 4-4. It could be a 4-3.
But it could be. Let's see. Kagan is out, so that leaves eight people. It could be with Scalia. Well, no, actually, with Scalia, then, if there were five people to reverse, there'd be four people to reverse, and it would be reversed because it would be 4-3. So in that case, if it was going to be affirmed 5-4 with Scalia being in the dissent, it would still be affirmed. It'll be 5-3 rather than 5-4. So that one is not cases where the result's going to change because they only have an 8-member court to begin with.
Another one that's certainly politically potent is the immigration case, Obama's executive order on undocumented children of immigrants.
Right, that's a good example. That case has not been argued yet, okay? So after the argument, you see how the eight people break down. If the eight people break down 4-4, that would mean that Kennedy would vote with the conservatives to uphold the decision below, which was to invalidate Obama's program. So if the case stands now 4-4 to invalidate, I think they'll just affirm by an equally divided court because it would have been 5-4 to invalidate Obama's program, even if Scalia participated. So there, the conservatives are going to say, let's affirm it 4-4. And the liberals might say, well, no, let's wait and see who the next appointment is. So that's what's going to go on within the court. And they're going to have to work that out among themselves. They could do either one of them. And I think it's going to turn on how strongly they feel about the case, what the vote is at this time, when they think they'll get a ninth member, and they don't know the answer to that. So because they don't know the answer to that, my guess is that they're going to lean in favor of just affirming them 4-4. But if it's a case they really care about, like the immigration case, they might say, no, let's hold it over. On the other hand, that's a temporary program.
Mm-hmm. Now,
so maybe they'll say, yeah, let's, you know, we might as well just affirm it, especially since the result there, if they affirm it, is going to be that Obama's program is invalid. So it would have to be the liberals on the court who would be asking to have the thing re-argued, hoping that they could get a ninth vote that would side with them.
You've mentioned a couple of times, sir, that it depends on how passionate someone is about a certain case or a certain issue. Is there a lot of communication amongst the justices? Do they play nice in the sandbox, or they just remain loyal to the party in which appointed them and they stick to those guns?
The latter, they never do. They don't remain loyal to the party. They don't think in party terms. I think that's generally true. Maybe occasionally, like in Bush and Gore, they think as party people. But they don't usually think in terms of Democrat or Republican. They think in terms of the results that they want versus the results that they don't want. And they do feel some people very strongly about some issues, some people not quite so strongly about those issues. The short answer to your question is they do talk to each other, and they are nice to each other, and they will talk over these things, and most of the time they resolve them in a way that they can all agree with. I'm talking about scheduling matters now, not the result of the case. But there may be some cases where some people want it re-argued and some people don't want it re-argued. And then they'll take a vote, and it'll be a majority vote that wins. And right now, who the hell is the majority? You got three really strong conservatives, four moderate liberals, and Kennedy. So as usual, Kennedy is the deciding vote on those kinds of things.
You know, you've painted a really interesting picture, and it's a distinction from Congress. I'm seeing nine people in a room together that know that they're going to have to work with these nine people for 15, 20, 25 years.
Exactly.
And that seems to me to induce a level of courtesy that you probably, and they don't have to justify it to the outside world. And in contrast to Congress, with, first of all, hundreds of members, and you don't have to live with them. A lot of them are in, they're out. There's shifting coalitions. It seems to me, I just see the interpersonal dynamic, of course, the famous friendship between Ginsburg and Scalia maybe kind of underscores that point.
That dynamic is very important, and it's not just that friendship. It's a general nicety of them to each other. And this Scalia's death is a very, very problematic thing. It causes a very difficult situation for them. They have heard a whole bunch of cases that he heard, and they voted on them, and now he can't participate. He might have written an opinion, which they were about to hand down next week. They can't do that. Because he can't hand down an opinion. Somebody else is going to have to hand down the opinion in that case.
Though I assume they could take his verbiage if they liked it.
They could if they want, or somebody else could write an opinion. So that's one problem. But the biggest problem is that Scalia's death may change the result of some cases that have already been argued. We don't know which ones those are. But that suddenly faces them with something they did not anticipate. And they're going to have to think about it and worry about it and talk to each other about it. And I think they will talk to each other. The strong divisions you see in the presidential primary elections do not exist on the court. They're not those unshakable blocks that I'll never agree with you about anything. That may be true about whether to overrule Roe and Wade. They're very strong. But on procedural stuff, they will tend to try to reach a consensus of the court about what most of them, or all of them, if possible, want to do.
Is some of that the division it is big? I notice you didn't characterize anyone as being a liberal on the court. Moderate liberals to conservative.
It depends on your definition of liberal.
Sure. Nobody. Well, William O. Douglas. I don't see a William O. Douglas on the court.
There isn't. There's no William Brennan. There's no Hugo Black. There's probably no Earl Warren. There's no liberal in that strong sense. What you have is people who are moderately liberal. Ginsburg, Breyer, Sotomayor, Kagan. I think they're all moderately liberal. And so that's why I keep saying moderates or moderate liberals, because there is no liberal on the court who is as strongly liberal as Scalia, Alito, Thomas, and Roberts. Those people are all more on the right side, further away from the middle on the right side, than anybody on the court is far away on the left side.
Mr. Paul Bender, we appreciate you spending some time with us. We know you got to get out of here. We really appreciate your insight. And as this process moves along, we'd love to hear more from you.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Have a wonderful day.
Thanks. Same to you. Bye-bye.
All right. Doc and I are going to tie a big fat bow around this one, all things Supreme Court, when we come back right here on The Think Tank.
The Think Tank. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
When talking Supreme Court, it's always good to have someone that worked on the Supreme Court in our backyard here to help us make sense of it all. And like I said, Doc, I think it's interesting when things like this happen that we get to take an advanced civics class. Because let's face it, we didn't cover any of this. When we talked about the Supreme Court in high school and maybe at the 101 level in college, we didn't talk about what happens when there's a 4-4 tie due to a death in a president's final year of his term. We don't talk about that.
It's a few years old, but if you want to get an insight into the workings of the court, the best book out there is still The Brethren.
Okay, The Brethren.
You know, it's about 20 years old. But in terms of the dynamic, I know, for example, think of the dynamic. They actually have, when they do their conferences, they close the door. There is no staff member. In fact, even closing the door is the task of the most junior member of the court.
Wow.
And who was it? I think it was
Kennedy. I'm the door closer.
Yeah, Kennedy, I think it was, that was in that role for like 10 years.
Really?
Yeah.
That's funny.
But so think of the interpersonal dynamic. You're in a room with 8 other people. And you're going to have to work with them for 20 years. It makes you play nice, not only because people are there personally, but also in terms of getting something done. It's very functional to that. You don't make enemies.
It would be so amazing to just be a fly in the wall. And that, think about it. I mean, do they take their robes off? Do they keep their robes on? Is their biggest debate what to order in while they're discussing these kinds of things? You know, it would just be absolutely fascinating to see these minds work like this. But
and you see insight in that.
Right.
Justice Ginsburg wrote a really moving piece about her friendship with Scalia.
Yeah.
She mentioned, among other things, at an intellectual level. Now, there are relative polar extremes, at least on the existing court.
Mm-hmm.
And she would say, my opinions would get better after I read his critique.
Nice.
And because he would be not intentionally, but he would go after her in certain respects. And she would recognize, she said, where the weaknesses in her own argument were. And she would beef those up.
I loved watching the two of them. They keep playing little parts of this over the two of them on stage. And one of the best things I would say about Scalia's whether he's in the majority or he's writing. He's snarky. Full of it, and I absolutely loved that. I loved getting the little pieces and sound bites from his opinions that just made you laugh.
I want to tell you about one other fascinating Scalia anecdote that I read, and this is David Axelrod is at some social. I think it was something where they were sitting down. There was an audience, a play or something, and they're sitting next to one another.
Uber liberal, David Axelrod.
And there is he's Obama's campaign manager. Okay?
I'm uber liberal. He can't get more liberal than that.
Scalia is next. There's a vacancy on the court. Scalia leans over to him and said, "I know you're not going to give me somebody that's my ideological crony, but," he says, "give me somebody smart. I want somebody, in effect, my intellectual equal to spar with."
Right.
And Axelrod is kind of astounded by that.
Sure.
And then,
because at the time he was an advisor for the Obama White House.
Yes.
At the time.
Oh yeah, he's in the White House.
This is no longer a campaign manager.
He is in the room when they're making the decision.
Yeah.
Okay. It's the president's decision, but David Axelrod is one of the guys, one of the four or five max guys who's in the room when
and
they're
one
talking
very
about.
Important
okay.
Female.
And then Scalia leans over a second time and he says, "Give me Elena Kagan."
Yeah.
Now, in that instance, they didn't. They gave her Sotomayor.
Right.
But Elena Kagan was the second appointment.
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
yeah.
Basically, and I understand that. You know, essentially, if you're going to argue with somebody and somebody's taking the other side, you want somebody smart.
Yeah, you don't
otherwise
want to play ball
it's
with
no
stupidity.
Fun.
You
right.
don't want to play ball with stupidity.
It's just no fun. You know, the vote's coming down the same way, but your life, the people that, again, there's only eight other people with whom you are significantly engaged,
yes.
and that person's going to be there for 20 years.
Yeah, exactly.
So you want a room filled with people that are going to challenge you.
Yes,
so.
or just keep up with you. Let's put it that way. Yep. I mean, let's be real. I don't know how much they're yearning for the challenge as much as they want somebody that can keep up. They don't have to bring them up to speed on things, and they can have a wonderful conversation. So. Yeah.
So I found that very, very. Now,
absolutely.
You wouldn't get that coming out of, you know, Congress, which is looking at this purely in ideological terms.
I would agree with that. But, I I'll tell you this. And I don't think it's even ideological terms. This is purely political. And I think the two are separate. I think the two are separate. As the Senate is saying that we are not going to confirm any. We might even get a hearing. We're not even going to schedule a hearing for whoever President Barack, the Muslim Kenyan that we don't want in the White House. We are not going to let him appoint another Supreme Court justice.
A dangerous thing. Let me give you a scenario for what I think what happened. First of all, the president can appoint whoever he wants.
Yep.
And Congress is absolutely free to do nothing.
Yep.
But they both have to live with the consequences of what they do.
Sure.
The president making an appointment is not going to cause him any flack at all, basically. I mean, it's in the Constitution. That's
right.
What you do. If Congress, as McConnell originally said, if they go to the point of not even hearing it, the Republicans will cheer. The Democrats will jeer, and this is where I think it will cost the Republicans. The independents, who don't have strong ideological bent, feel very strongly about nonpartisan activity, and I think it hurts the Republicans among independents in the presidential election.
Here's where I think it helps them. I think it helps. I think this is a decent – it could be if it works out.
If they don't even do hearings.
Well, hold on a second. The threat, I think, right now – is a good play. If they end up going through on their word, then I'll agree with you. I'll agree with you. Hold on a second there. But if it's just the screaming and hollering, no way, snowball's chance in hell that this is going to happen. We're not going to any name that leaves Barack Obama's mouth is not going to be a Supreme Court justice, right? Might. President Obama, if nothing else, has a very large ego. Let's just be real. You have to be a complete narcissist to run for president of the United States. It's just how it is. You have to love you some you. His ego will throw a moderate out there. I think his ego will throw a straight line straight down the center, maybe a little left-leaning, I get it.
Well, frankly, what his appointments have been.
I don't know much about that.
There is no William Brennan on the court. There is no William O. Douglas.
If you're going to set the bar there,
A Scalia clone on the other side, there is none.
Okay, so he said, okay.
Or Alito.
All right, so we're going to do this. So if he sends a straight line down the middle, okay, send a straight line, they affirm them. They affirm them and say, okay, we didn't get a Sotomayor, we didn't get a Kagan. It's okay, good for now. We got a down the middle call because we screamed and hollered so much that he called our bluff at it and gave us something that we knew we would affirm. Does that make sense? And so it plays to both hands.
And we know who those people are, by the way, because there are a couple of appellate court judges who were appointed by President Obama within the last 2 years who were unanimously confirmed.
Sure.
In other words, you know, you can't have a hint of liberalism in your blood, or you're not getting unanimity.
But those were different times, though. Those were different times when they were shot through. You got to look at it from the conservative Republican standpoint. Sure, they voted for him, but like we got President Barack Obama in there. Of course, it's going to be a liberal. Throw him in there.
It's just going to be very difficult for a Republican. They'll do it. But it'll be very difficult for a Republican senator to explain, why did I just vote to confirm this person to the appellate court, which is just a notch below the Supreme Court,
right?
And now I'm voting against them. Now, by the way, they'll get cheers for that in Republican. The ones that are going to be primaried or that have primary opponents are going to, no way, they're going to vote no. John McCain, prior to the primary election, there is no way he's voting for anybody.
It's the same way, you know what? It's the same way the Democrats are doing right now. When they kicked and screamed that it was the president's last term, and I mean last year in office, they did this same garbage, and now they're saying, "Oh, well, don't use that against me. That was apples and oranges." It's the same nonsense that comes from both sides of the aisle.
I don't dispute, but it's not. I'm trying to deal with what the politics is right now. I mean, let's take John McCain as an example.
Sure.
Obama appoints somebody very, very moderate.
Okay.
Pre-primary, McCain votes no.
Okay.
After the primary, I think he might vote yes.
I think it's the same on both sides.
Because after the primary, he's looking at a serious challenge by a Democrat, and he wants to become moderate John McCain.
Yeah, absolutely. No. I'm sorry. Every Democrat's doing the same thing. I think it's silly.
Look at whether this occurs before or after primary elections.
Then let's bring up Chuck Schumer. And Chuck Schumer's now eating a whole lot of crow right now.
Nobody's saying this doesn't.
Everybody.
On procedural matters, everybody's in Washington. It's a hypocrite.
Thank you. That's all I want. Okay. See? That's what we come to agreement on the think tank.
Never contested that one.
Okay.
If you want to get to any old shows that we've done, they are at mikeoneal.org. You can go there anytime. There's a button at the top that says radio. You will see a podcast of every show we've ever done in case you are sick in bed and you want to listen to
something. You're sick in bed. Listen, worst case scenario, go ahead and check out
119 hours of it, folks.
Holy cow. Good. Have we done 119 hours?
We have done
hours?
119 shows.
Do we get a medal? Do we get a LADMO bag? We should get a LADMO bag.
They've all been given out.
Yes, they have.
No, you cannot. Nobody gets a LADMO bag.
Thanks for spending some time with us right here on the Think Tank.